Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Violence strikes the nation's capital as a Republican congressman is shot, apparently by a zealot from the other side. We talk with Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert about how Wisconsin lawmakers are reacting. Back in Wisconsin, big questions remain after a sheriff's deputy killed a young African-American man last weekend on the lakefront. Dan Bison, Ernie Franzen will discuss. And legislators consider whether the nation should call a constitutional convention to force action on a balanced budget amendment to the U.S. Constitution. All that and more today from the best political team in Wisconsin on Politics. Welcome to On Politics. I'm David Hainsey, opinions editor of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Well, we had some breaking news out of Madison today, and we're going to go to Patrick Marley, who we talked to just moments ago. So now we're joined by Patrick Marley. Patrick, welcome to On Politics.
Hey, thanks, David.
So some breaking news in Madison today. Bring us up to date.
So it looks like Justice Gableman will not run for re-election. He was elected in 2008 in his first 10-year term. We hadn't known what he was going to do. A couple of candidates had announced they were running against him. Now word is out that he'll be announcing today he is not going to seek re-election.
So was that a surprise, Patrick?
Well, it was and it wasn't. As I said, he's had two candidates come out running against him from the left. He has never really responded to what he was going to do. He's never said if he was going to run again, so he left that question out there. I've been talking in recent months to people sort of familiar with his thinking, and they were reporting that they were getting mixed messages, that at one time he'd be very serious about running for re-election and another time thinking that he wouldn't do it. So it looks like he's reached a decision here.
So that opens up a seat on the court, and Gableman has been a reliable conservative with the conservative bloc in the court. How do you think that plays out? What do you think is Gableman's legacy?
Well, he's been part of some very big decisions over the last 10 years, as you'd expect. The terms are very long on the court. He was one of the votes that found that Act 10 was constitutional. He was one of the votes that upheld Act 10, the changes to collective bargaining law, found that it was lawfully enacted. He was one of the votes for upholding the state's voter ID law. He was a key vote on the decision that struck down ended the investigation of Scott Walker's campaign. So those are some of the biggest cases that he's dealt with in the most recent years.
Right. And what does his withdrawing or deciding not to run, what does that do to the potential race here?
Well, I mean, really now we've got two candidates, both of whom spoke at the Democratic Party convention recently, had put themselves forward as sharp alternatives to Gableman. There is no conservative candidate in the race right now. I'm sure that will change. We'll see somebody come up, and then it will be an open race. Unless there's an appointment. I mean, I guess one thing we don't know at this point is if Justice Gableman is just simply not running for re-election or if he is stepping down. If he resigns, then Governor Walker gets to appoint his replacement. That would give that person a leg up in the election next year.
The benefit of incumbency. So let's move to one other issue. The legislature, the Assembly yesterday passed at least one bill, I think there might have been more than one bill, that dealt with this issue of a constitutional amendment. Can you briefly explain what happened there?
Yeah, there was actually three pieces of legislation, but the key one would add Wisconsin to the list of states calling for a constitutional convention to amend the Constitution to require a federally balanced
Constitution.
The U.S. Constitution. Yeah. So you need two-thirds of the states, so 34 states have to do that. If the state Senate goes along with the assembly and does this, we would become state number 28 calling for a convention. If you hit 34, then you get delegates from all the states together. They propose any amendments to the U.S. Constitution. Then Those would have to be ratified by three quarters of the states. So that's 38, I believe. The conservatives say it's very much needed because this federal budget is out of control. The Democrats were warning them that once you call a constitutional convention, anything is fair game. People could start making changes to the First Amendment or get rid of the Second Amendment or, amend, get rid of Citizens United decision, any number of things that could come up that conservatives might not like.
And where's that expected to go in both the Senate and with Governor Walker?
Well, so the governor does not have a say in this one. This would be simply something that the legislature calls for. And though the governor has said that he thinks it makes sense to have a constitutional convention on the federal budget, I'm not sure what its chances are in the state Senate. It may be able to get through. You know, there were seven Republicans in the state assembly who voted against this, so it's not a lock. There are some Republicans who are not on board with it. I'm not sure if that means it's got, there's a thinner majority in the state Senate, so I don't know what its chances are at this point.
All right. Well, Patrick Marley, thanks so much for that update.
Thank you.
So now I'm back live with Dan Bice, columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and Ernie Franzen, an associate editorial page editor at the Journal Sentinel. Welcome, guys. Dan,
thanks.
Turn to you first. Justice Gableman not running. What are the political implications?
Well, the big question would be, does he serve out his term? Because if he serves out his term, then it's an open seat and it's a free for all. What the Walker people, I'm assuming in hearing, they want him to step down early. Making this clear now means that you could have a clean break because the term goes through through July and starts again in August, and that's when they start hearing new cases. So if he steps down now or at the end of this term, then Walker could appoint somebody to replace him. And that person then obviously is an incumbent, and whoever's running is running against a sitting justice. So,
and that's what he did last time,
right?
With Rebecca Bradley,
right? And so you have Rebecca Bradley in office, and it's a much tougher fight. But if Gableman had stayed on, he was going to see opposition clearly already from the left, and then the question from the right. When Justice Ziegler ran last time, no one challenged her, and much of the discussion was those who wanted to run saw it as a much easier race if you run against Gableman than you ran against Ziegler. So, and I didn't quite understand that because you can actually run against both. It didn't have to be either or. But I think that's the big question is, does he step down early? And if he does it, who does Walker appoint? Walker just recently passed over appeals court Judge Gundrum for the position, highly regarded and someone who clearly has an interest. His former staff attorney, Brian Hagedorn, is an appeals court judge. Mm-hmm. So there are people out there that he could appoint for this position.
So Ernie, on Gableman's record.
Yeah. Well, he's certainly one of the more conservative members of the court. He wrote, he was the prime author on the ruling on the Act 10 legislation. So he was a prime target for Democrats who wanted to kick back in some way after the recent election losses. Editorially, we had urged Walker, when he appointed Rebecca Bradley, not to do that, or at least to appoint someone who would promise not to run in the spring. Mm-hmm. That advantage of incumbency, even if it's for 6 months or something, is a very strong advantage. So, I think we would hope, again, that he doesn't, that he appoints someone who will commit to not running, or he doesn't appoint someone.
It's interesting when Gableman won, and it was a nasty race, the nastiest Supreme Court race that we probably ever had in the state.
Right.
The thinking was Gableman's in his 40s; he could be on the court for 30 years, and so forth. And now we're finding out he may not even serve out his 10-year term. Right. So a very interesting turn of events.
Yeah, and he sort of alluded that he was going to run for more than just one term, at least with Patrick Marley, as Patrick mentioned, a couple of years ago. So it does come as a bit of a surprise, at least to me, that he would step down now or get out now.
Okay. Well, let's leave it there. I want to next go to our Washington Bureau Chief, Craig Gilbert, who's had a chance to speak with some of the members of Congress who were at that
Really terrifying event yesterday in Alexandria, Virginia. Let's go to Craig now.
Well, Craig, welcome to On Politics. I know you've been talking with some members of the Republican caucus who were actually at this baseball practice yesterday. What did you hear from them?
Well, you know, it was pretty chilling to talk to them. You know, this is the congressional charity baseball game is sort of an iconic kind of feel-good bipartisan institution in Washington that's more than 100 years old. And so it was sort of their shock at this happening there, of all places, and obviously, you know, finding themselves under fire at a baseball practice. You know, the other chilling thing about it, as many of them pointed out, is that the only reason there was any armed security there at all was because one of their players is the House Majority Whip, Steve Scalise, and he's one of three Republicans who get routine Capitol Hill personal security wherever they go because they're part of the leadership team. If he hadn't been at the practice, they wouldn't have had any Capitol Police security, and obviously the casualties would have been much worse.
So there's always been this debate about congressmen need to be out in the open talking to the people, but especially since the Gabby Giffords assassination attempt a few years ago, there's this discussion about security. I got to think that there's going to be more discussion now about what else can be done to secure congressmen when they're out in public.
Yeah, and I think that applies to town hall meetings, which, again, we're seeing fewer town hall meetings because they become so politically kind of turbulent. It applies to a lot of different things, and it's complicated by just, you know, a subject that came up a lot yesterday, which is sort of the tone and tenor of our politics. It didn't take long for some people in the political world to start pointing fingers, blaming. I know there were obviously people pointing the finger at the political left for the political rhetoric, just as people on the left have blamed the right for its rhetoric when violence has occurred in the past. There was a real genuine effort, I think, by most members of Congress, including the House Speaker Paul Ryan. I went to his address yesterday in the House chamber. That was an unusual and somber event, to kind of get beyond all that and come together. And so there was some genuine kind of across the partisan aisle solidarity being felt yesterday. But again, you had this sort of, it didn't take long around the periphery of that for these kind of symptoms of how bitter our divisions are to kind of creep into the public debate.
And it should be pointed out that the shooter apparently was a Bernie Sanders supporter, was very anti-Trump, you believe what he was saying on social media. But the president was very tempered in his remarks.
He was. I think overall the political leadership in both parties set a pretty good tone yesterday by not pointing fingers, by trying to kind of appeal to everybody's best instincts. That's, you know, whether that has any lasting effect, probably not. But I think it's certainly the appropriate tone to carry, and it's genuine for a lot of people in both parties.
Well, as you said, a very frightening episode yesterday. Let's move on to another issue that may be arising fairly quickly here. There's a lawsuit that is making its way possibly to the U.S. Supreme Court on redistricting in Wisconsin. Can you explain what's going on there?
Yeah, so there's this big legal fight, which is kind of introducing a really interesting and critical legal question, is whether a political map can be so partisan, so tilted, so advantage one party that it violates the Constitution. And actually a federal panel decided that the Wisconsin map did violate the Constitution for that reason. Now we'll find out, perhaps as soon as Monday, how the Supreme Court is going to handle this. They have to take the case, but they can either issue a summary judgment for one side or the other, or they can, and this is sort of what most people expect, schedule oral arguments and really fully hear the case, which could be a groundbreaking case with huge political implications for both sides. I mean, this is a, you know, the legal questions are kind of murky, but the political questions are, to me, are pretty clear. This is a very tilted map we have in Wisconsin that kind of locks in Republican control of the legislature, whether it's a good or bad year for Republicans in statewide elections.
Right. And the Republicans would argue that a lot of that had to do with just where people live. They're concentrated in Milwaukee and in
right.
Dane County.
So they have a point to a point. I mean, that is part of the problem that the Democrats have, is that they've their rural weakness and their voters are kind of inefficiently concentrated and over concentrated for the purposes of district elections in these urban districts, especially Milwaukee and Madison. So they have an inherent disadvantage in the map. But on top of that kind of natural disadvantage, which existed before the current map, it existed in the old map. But if you look at the districts before the new lines were drawn and after, you can see that on top of the natural disadvantage that Democrats have, the Republicans piled on an additional burden and made the lines that much more disadvantageous. I mean, basically, let's say if you go by presidential and gubernatorial voting, let's say, you know, just rule of thumb that Republicans out of the 99 assembly districts may have had a built-in advantage in 55 or 56 of them, and now they have a built-in advantage in 63 or 64 of them. So that's 7 or 8 more seats, and it's a, you know, 15-point larger margin in the assembly that they start out with at the beginning of an election cycle.
All right. Well, Craig Gilbert, thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
So now we're back with Ernie Franzen and Dan Bison. Ernie, let me turn to you. There was a really scary incident on the lakefront last weekend where a driver was attempting to flee, drove up on the median strip there down by Tower Road, and was shot to death by a sheriff's deputy who shot into the moving car, wounded a woman in the car as well.
Right.
There's a lot we don't know yet about this. Sheriff Clark, I guess the next day, had a news conference. What do you make of how Sheriff Clark handled this incident at this point?
You know, I'm not the sheriff's favorite person, and he's not, and you are, and he's not mine either. But I do think that he handled this as well as any professional, as a professional police officer would, or law enforcement officer. They released the name of the deputy involved. That took a much longer time in the Jay Anderson case than what Tulsa. I don't think Tulsa handled that particularly well. I think he released the information that he could. We don't know what happened. Mm-hmm. The video of the shooting doesn't show us what was going on inside the vehicle or how the officer or whether the officer felt threatened. So I think, the sheriff did pretty much a pretty good job.
The one thing he didn't do, though, was take any questions from the media.
True.
He controlled what he controlled.
Yeah.
One thing, he wasn't even in town on Sunday, as I understand it. He was in Washington, D.C., so maybe he's catching up along with everybody else. He is someone who likes to have control, and it wasn't like the Sherman Park situation where you had dueling press conferences and Bear holding one and Flynn holding one press conference and then the Sheriff mm-hmm. Clark holding another one. It was much more restrained. It would have been nice to know what their policy is in terms of chases. I don't know what their policy is. I would have liked to have heard someone ask him that question and mm-hmm. gotten some feedback, mm-hmm. and whether they have a policy on shooting moving vehicles, which is a very unusual.
And especially in a crowded situation like that, where you've got a lot of people standing around, as you do on the lakefront. Experts advise it's probably not a good thing to do in any case to shoot into a moving vehicle, because the vehicle itself then becomes a missile.
Right.
So that could, but this. This wasn't much of a chase. I mean, it wasn't very long.
I was going to say, it wasn't a high-speed chase.
Not at all.
Driving slowly down the road.
He was trying
up on the median.
Now Williams was, Terry Williams was the victim, and he apparently was involved in a shooting incident on Saturday. This is speculation, but possibly he thought they were looking for him for that. There was a temporary felony warrant out on him, I think, on that.
There was a gun
inside the vehicle.
But they had no way of knowing that.
Yeah, so we don't know if the deputies were aware of that other warrant. But he may have thought, you know, I need to get out of here. The key question, as you raise, is what did that deputy, who was not behind him but in front of him, or at least near in front of him, who was on foot patrol, what did he see? How did he react? Why did he react the way he did?
As some of the stories pointed out, it wasn't clear whether the car was coming directly at him, if he might have felt threatened by that. So a lot to be.
And the sheriff also didn't say, I'm sorry, the sheriff also didn't say whether, he said that the weapon was found in the vehicle, didn't say whether he was being brandished by anybody in the vehicle, and whether he was holding it, whether the deputy saw it.
So the priority is getting to the bottom of everything that occurred with the shooting and, you know, what the causes were for this. But there's also this political background, which is secondary for Sheriff Clark, which is he's announced that he's taking a job with the Trump administration. The Trump administration hasn't said that he does have a job. So he's got to be careful in how he handles the situation with people in Washington. I mean, if it blows up into a, you know, he mishandles it or says something inappropriately, then that could affect that job, whether he has it or not.
And he didn't do any of that. He acted appropriately in that press conference. He reacted appropriately, could have told us more, could have taken questions, but he didn't, you know, go beyond what he
Disclose information.
Facebook.
He did do a good job in terms of disclosing certain information about the deputy who did the shooting, how long he's been with the police force, age, and those other details.
And now Waukesha County has taken over the investigation. That's important, but I also hope sometimes these investigations seem to drag on too long and we don't get any information for months and months. I hope they can expedite this and provide
and
us with something sooner.
The Waukesha sheriff who asked him not to talk because he didn't have much to say either. So, but yeah, you're right. Like the Tulsa situation did drag on for a long time.
Yeah.
And there was,
we didn't know the name of the officer for a long time.
Right. So.
All right. Well, we'll leave that one there. We have time for one question, and I'll leave it up to you two over who wants to take it.
Ernie's.
One of our viewers wants to know, so what's up with Dennis Rodman in North Korea?
That is clearly yours. I handle Wisconsin issues. And
Dennis Rodman returned to North Korea. If you remember, a few years ago, he went and met with the dictator there, Kim Jong-un. And is now apparently back, and the viewer wants to know why don't we haul him in front of the Senate and find out what's going on?
I think he's on vacation. I think he just likes North Korea. He wants to go back, sun himself on the beaches, and have some drinks with his buddy, the dictator there. And
it is a pretty bizarre scene.
Jong-un,
Dennis Rodman, North Korea. Kim Jong-un.
I'm not sure that questioner realizes what show this is.
No, I mean, Rodman is Rodman. It's just bizarre. It's bizarre. It's we live in a bizarre world, and that's certainly one of the examples.
Rodman has some connection to Trump, doesn't he? I think he and Trump are buddies from the past.
That sounds familiar. I don't think he's, you know.
You don't think he's acting at the behest of the
president? I don't think he's acting at the behest of the president. Yeah.
I doubt it.
I'm more interested in talking about our winners and losers.
As we should.
Well, let's go to winners and losers then. So, Ernie, let me start with you. Who's your winner?
Capitol Police. They showed Monday, they showed in the shooting that the important job that police do in protecting us every day across the country. They also showed the risks that police face every day. So, Capitol Police did a great job. They saved some lives. Now, part of that was luck because they were part of a detail that wouldn't have been there had
the
House Whip not been there. So a bit of luck was involved, but for me it's Capitol Police.
All right, and who's your loser?
I think the city of Milwaukee, or at least, city of Milwaukee. I mean, you've got a number of shootings over the last weeks. You've got a police officer on trial for the Sherman Park thing. You've got a deputy involved in a lakefront shooting. None of that obviously is good. And then when the mayor announces that he may have to cut 84 police officers due to budget shortfall, it just gets worse. And the pushback is already that, well, you can build a trolley. Why can't you do this? Or why can't you kill the trolley and then provide that money? Well, the money comes from different pots of gold, but pots of revenue. But it's not a good time to be the mayor of Milwaukee. I wouldn't want that job.
All right, Dan, who's your loser?
So my loser is Andy Gronick. He's a Democrat looking to run for governor. He's very serious about that. He's polled, already hired a staff member, and is looking to do it. And he was asked this week, why he didn't sign the Walker recall petition, which would be very important to Democrats in the primary. And he said he didn't because no one asked him to do so. Because
they were around. You could have found one.
In fact, I couldn't get away from them. When I went to the grocery store,
right.
They came to my
right.
house.
Right.
People even did it at my church. So I don't know where he was, where these people that weren't asking him the questions, but it's sort of a bizarre answer. I know he was embroiled in this major lawsuit that went for like 5 or 6 years. Maybe that was his focus, but it was, you know, I don't think any of us had any. I mean, I assume you were asked more than once to sign the thing.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
He lives in Fox Point, which is a place where I'm guessing a lot of people were out circulating.
They were going door to door.
And in fact, I think the Democratic Party would have records as to whether they went to his house or not. Not that the party is going to share that stuff, but I think people do know whether they went to his house. So
Andy Granick, who's your winner?
Foxconn, it's a firm that that does parts for Apple phones. It's seriously looking at moving a plant here, which would mean thousands and thousands of jobs. Scott Walker's jobs record is not very good. To get something like this would be a big boost the year before an election year. So even though it's an economic development issue, it could quickly become a political issue. As we saw, Donald Trump alluded to this. Scott Walker has made reference to this. So this is something that could be a big thing. And I'll add a second winner. The late breaking news about the Supreme Court, I think our other winner would be if Scott Walker gets to make an appointment. I would guess that he would probably choose appeals court judge Brian Hagedorn. And so that would be, he would be the winner in this whole situation. And that's very predictive. But I think he would have to be the front runner right now if Walker gets to appoint a replacement for Gableman.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Thanks, Dan and Ernie. Also, thanks to Patrick Marley from our Madison Bureau and Craig Gilbert of our Washington Bureau. I'm Dave Haynes for On Politics.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.